Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I get to welcome to the show Dr. Pillay, who is a best-selling author, business coach, musician, and the host of Big Ticket Clients podcast. I love to talk to other podcasts. We're going to have a lot of fun with this, and he's going to share a lot of information. And this podcast is where he features the stories of highly successful experts, consultants, and entrepreneurs. And he also helps consultants, coaches, and experts leverage the power of social media and podcasting to land big-ticket clients online. He has a fascinating story. Born and raised in a war-torn African refugee village, he was named after Pele. I apologize if I'm not getting that right, but Pele, I'm trying to get this right, of Brazil. You know, the greatest soccer player on earth, and whose influence was so great that it stopped a bloody civil war. Now, he has internalized his namesake's simple yet powerful secret of success, which is practice, and later transformed it, developing his unique skills in art, music, writing, and motivational speaking. He has authored several books, major label songs, and has spoken to diverse business audiences. Good morning. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's so good to have you here.
Good morning, Denise. Thanks for having me.
Okay, before I butcher your name again, and I so apologize, pronounce it properly so people understand how to address you, and I do apologize for that.
Oh, no need for an apology. It's Dr. Pillay, and as you rightly said, I'm named after Pele, the greatest soccer player ever, I think some people might argue, but his pronunciation is Pele. Mine is Pillay. So if you think of fish fillet, as we were saying earlier, it's Dr. Pillay.
Got it. And I think that's where my problem came, because I did look up, and I know, of course, who the soccer player is. Who doesn't? And, you know, I knew that that was how it was pronounced, and I got it in my head that that was it. So anyway,
yeah,
I just wanted to make sure that we have it correct. Look, I have a last name that nobody can pronounce, so I understand the problems. So listen, you have a fascinating personal history, and I mean, it's fascinating. I've looked you up. I've been looking at your book, and I've read your website. Share with us how you made your way from a war zone in Africa to the heights of corporate America, and now to writing books, music, coaching, top-rating consultants, and B2B companies, and this terrific podcast you've got. Share a bit with us before we get too far into how we do things, if you don't mind.
No, thank you so much, Denise. I appreciate that. You know, my story is probably not too different from the stories of so many people around the world who have come from very far places, very deep in poverty, very tough circumstances, but have somehow found a way to arrive here where we actually can communicate on your wonderful podcast, for example. So for anyone who's ever gone through the path of, you know, coming from nothing, if you will, to something, this may resonate with you. I was born in the mid-60s. And in 1967, I was actually one of the child refugees in a small breakaway country called Biafra. Now, Nigeria is the country that was the actual government, was called Nigeria. But this small little tribe called the Igbos, a very stubborn tribe, formed their own country called Biafra. And they really wanted to chart their own way in the world. And so they broke away from Nigeria in 1967, around that time period. And it was a bloody civil war, probably the bloodiest civil war that I think Africa had seen up until that point. Obviously, there have been others after that. But back then, there were millions and millions of people dying every day, children starving. I was one of those starving children. If you've ever watched one of those, maybe National Geographic movies or something where you see the children in black and white with big stomachs suffering from kwashiorkor and, you know, flies buzzing around their mouths. Okay, I was one of those children. So we had no money. We had no food. We were afraid of being bombed or killed all the time. And the amazing thing is that my mother did one thing to me that changed the course of my life. Where she couldn't provide food, where she couldn't provide safety, she would simply sit me down and sing songs to me. And she would sit me down and tell me stories. And somehow those stories and those songs removed my need for food, my need for a sense of safety. I just, everything was fine because of her voice, the stories, the singing. And it led me toward a life that basically revolves around a couple of things. If I have a problem, I'll sing a song about it. If I have a business to run or a person to interact with, I'll tell a story about it because that's my way of survival. And I've told myself stories as much as I've told the world stories and told others stories ever since I was young. So I feel very fortunate that at an early age, my mother was able to replace fear with love and with storytelling and with African soup. You know, I have a song called Mama's Soup that I wrote, which tells that story. So that's how storytelling and music came into my life and became the thing that is, or the two things together, I guess you could say, that have driven everything I do. But the story of Pele probably has as much of an influence in my story as any other. See, back in that same time period, in 1967, during that war, the most amazing thing happened. Brazil had won the soccer World Cup, I think twice up until that point. They were just an unbelievable team. And the star that had made that happen was Pele, the soccer player, the greatest soccer player in some people's estimations. And so what happened is that he announced a world tour. He was going to go around the world, and he was going to play soccer as an exhibition match in different countries. And this is actually a story that you can find online on Time magazine. Time carried this story, actually, back when it happened, and it's still available online. So what happened was he announced that he was going to play soccer in Nigeria during the Civil War. So you can imagine people are dying, people are, you know, afraid. And he says, I'm just going to show up in your country and play soccer. Is that okay with you? Now, if you are a soccer fan or you understand how soccer is viewed all over the world, perhaps even more and more in the United States, any country felt privileged at that time, even a country that was deep in war. And so Nigeria decided with Biafra, you know, the two warring clans, to stop the war for 2 days. They agreed to a ceasefire for 48 hours so that Pele, the greatest soccer player on earth, could come and play soccer at their stadium. Imagine that. They actually stopped killing each other for those 2 days. And for me, that was so powerful. That was why my father decided to give me the name Pele, because he wanted his son to have someday the kind of influence and power that he had seen demonstrated. Now, I certainly don't have Pele's level of influence, but the word influence has been the reason why I've gone on to get a PhD in topics like leadership development, of which influence is everything, marketing, management, all the things that you would imagine influence has to be a part of. And of course, storytelling is a form of influence. And so while I'm not Pele, of course, I'm a singer, songwriter, musician, storyteller, and business owner who really believes in the power of your reputation preceding you.
I am almost slack-jawed. I almost can't even respond to this story. It's just so powerful. How old were you when you arrived at America?
I got here at about the age of somewhere between 5 and 6 in like 1971, 72. And at that point, I was introduced to my stepmother. Her name is Junie. She lives in Minnesota, and she's a Caucasian. I'm, of course, a black person. I learned English. I became an American right from there. And so most of my life has been, I have been an American most of my life. But I did go back to Nigeria during the late, well, between the 70s and 80s, and then came back at the end of the 80s again. So I was extremely young when I came the first time, and then I came back after my father died in the late 80s.
Your parents weren't able to come with you?
Well, my mother wasn't able to come with me because my father divorced her, left her. So after the war, my father left my biological mother and took me alone to America, where I met my stepmother, who is a white American. And I like to make that distinction, not because I believe color matters so much, but that has been another blessing in my life, which is I don't really understand when people have issues with racism, because number one, I came from a place where there's a worse kind of racism. It's called tribalism, where people hate you just because you're not in the same tribe or the same family. And because I was brought up by a woman who is white while I'm black, and I just don't understand why we can't all get over the question of complexion. So I feel that's another blessing. I have a very unique worldview into the question of intolerance just because people are different from other people. So that's why I bring that up. But yeah, I was extremely young, but I have a very solid Nigerian sort of heritage. I went back and I've learned the language. I speak Igbo fluently, which is my native tongue. And, you know, I can go back and forth with, you know, without losing any identity questions or anything like that.
I find this entirely fascinating, and I have to ask your mother, is she still living? Is she okay?
My stepmother is still living, and my biological mother is still living. I have a very wonderful relationship with both of them.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Listen, I find this fascinating that you... Look, I have often believed that people who come to America as immigrants are so thankful to be here. I mean, look, I'm an American born and bred. All of my family, we've been here for centuries. I love America. I always have. I always will. And it grieves me to no end to, you know, that people hate America or don't like America or they're screaming racism or intolerance. I don't understand it. I flat don't understand it. But what I have noticed is that many people who come here from, you know, countries like you did, who are so grateful to be in a country where, you know, there's an awful lot of living to be done. And I'm so glad that you made it here.
Thank you.
So before we get started, and thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's a very powerful history. I mean, just amazingly powerful. But what you did, so let's kind of go back to when you were six and you started learning English, and you still realized, I think, that, you know, your voice is important, your music is important, your stories are important, oral histories, so important. How did you go from, it had to have been confusing to go from one country to another where you don't really speak the language, so you've got an awful lot of learning and, you know, things that are going on that can probably be very confusing. How did you go from that to creating this lifestyle that you've created? Is it just such a passion with you, or is it something that because of who you were and who you are that is just critical that you share?
I think it's probably a little of all of those elements. And I think I would even go back to your sort of initial comment about race relations in America versus how those of us who have just come in as immigrants may view the country. I think that the story that we carry within us has a lot to do with where we end up. It has a lot to do with the perspective that we have. You know, a lot of people, when they talk about storytelling, they talk about the telling. I also like to think about story listening, because we're telling ourselves stories all the time, whether we like it or not, or whether we know it or not. And coming from...
And whether they're true or not. Seriously.
Exactly. Whether
we honestly find sometimes that our so-called history is just bunk. It's garbage.
Yeah, yeah. Whether they're true or not, very true. And so, you know, for me, you know, I came with a story that said, my father is a PhD. My father had a he got his doctorate degree from the University of Minnesota. My mother, my biological mother, who was left in Africa after the war, went on herself to be a PhD. Both of them highly educated. My white American mother, who is my stepmother, I call her mom, by the way. There's no distinction for me. She also is highly educated, University of Minnesota. She has a master's, and she is very focused on education as well. So for me, that was the story I saw everywhere. I also saw the story of hunger and pain starting from a very young age, separation from my mother. And those stories made me a little bit clingy to things like success, clingy to things like, you know, loyalty and love for other people. And so I come completely untouched by the story of slavery and the difficulties that some people, that the African Americans here have experienced. I'll tell you, and I wasn't planning on talking about this much, but Denise, I want you to know I really enjoy your questions, and your soft voice just takes me deep into myself. So with your permission, I'm going to tell you a story that I just experienced 2 weeks ago about that sort of clarifies what I'm trying to say here. And that is, I was at a bar. I was playing music with some friends at this bar, and I was sitting down having a beer, and a gentleman came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, I like your music. What's your name?" I said, "My name is Dr. Pelé." And he said, "Oh, no. I mean, what's your real name?" I said, "My name is Dr. Pelé." He said, No. What is your slave name?" Okay.
Oh, he did not.
Yes, he did. That floored me. It floored the people around us. Someone made the excuse that he's drunk. Someone confronted him.
I don't care. That's disgusting, and it's stupid.
Someone confronted him. We had a little bit of a situation. I got up. I went to the elevator and was about to leave because I've heard far too many stories. I did not want to become a story. But when I got to the elevator, I decided, you know what? I've been running all my life. I'm not going to run from this. I'm going to go back in there, and I'm going to find a separate seat, and I'm going to sit down. But I will not let this man chase me out of this bar with the insensitive comment. So to the point you made earlier, African Americans in this country are living a reality. They're not making it up. It's happening now, and it's really not fair. At the same time, it's easy for me to erase what happened 2 weeks ago because, you know, I'm healthy enough to not carry that story everywhere I go. So I think it's a combination of accepting the fact that some people have a reality that they're living. Other people have a set of privileges that they're living. And we all just need to know what these things are.
Listen, I live in the Deep South, and you would think that we would have all kinds of race issues. We don't. We just don't. We get along just fine. We always have. I mean, I've lived here, for more than half of my life, and I was a bit surprised. I was kind of almost anticipating that, you know, there was going to be black and there was going to be white and there was going to be Cajun. It's not. We all get along just fine. I have never, in all the years that I've lived here, experienced any kind of racism at all, black, white, or purple. It's just how we operate. And this is just kind of my my observation. I don't know that it's true or not, but I find that big cities where the people are packed tight and they're miserable, I think that's where more problems are. When you get to more urban areas, or like, you know, I'm farm country basically, we're fine. We get along just fine. We don't want any problems. We just want to go about our business and do the best we can. And I could be dead wrong, but it just seems to me that the more packed in you get, the more you pick up the mores of other people, I think, and you're not listening to your own story and your own voice and trying to define what really is true. Is it true? Is it not true? Does it help you? Does, you know, is it harmful? People don't seem to stop and think. You know, I don't care if I'm black, white, or purple. I really don't. I'm me, and I'm terrific. And I wish more of us would think like that.
Absolutely.
Okay, now we're both on a rant. So, listen, thank you for that story. I mean, the guy who said that, I'm not going to say again how, well, yeah, I am. That was just stupid. Okay, so let's talk. And I'm glad that you took the opportunity to say, hey, you know, I'm not going to allow this to become my reality, because it really isn't your reality, is it?
No, and actually, I appreciate that it happened, because I wrote a song about it. You know, these experiences, yeah, I have a new song that I'm about to launch. It's called Give Us Free. And this incident inspired it. If you've ever watched a movie called Amistad, Amistad, yeah, Amistad is a great movie by Steven Spielberg. And in it, the African slave used the word "give us free." You know, that was the only English he knew. So he said, "Give us free." You know, in this very landmark scene. And I wrote a song called Give Us Free, and here are the words of the song. I pulled it up as you were talking. It goes, Do you remember when we were young? You were my friend. We were singing the same song. Then we got older, and life's reality made you a kingdom and me a refugee. But are we really all that different? Said the blackbird to the dove. When will we transcend complexion? When will we discover all we need is love? Give us free, give us freedom. That's the first verse. So,
lovely.
You know,
when it's ready and, yeah, and out there, will you send me a link?
I absolutely will.
Thank you. I would love to have it.
It's one of those things where it's a gift. Sometimes you get these silver linings from the difficulties in your life, and that's one thing I really hold on to.
No, you're absolutely true. Listen, I have found in my life that, you know, people say, oh, I'm having a bad day or I'm having a good day. You're having a bad day and a good day multiple times during the same 24 hours. That's just the way
yeah.
it works.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't see why people try to, you know, oh, I'm having a bad day. No, you're not. You might have had a bad day 10 minutes ago. But you're fine now because I just heard you laughing, so get over it. Just keep
yeah.
on moving. But I find that stopping, thinking, listening, music is hugely important to me. I mean, massively important. I'm always singing. Yeah, I'm one of those people that I sing all the time by myself. I don't sing out public. But I love to sing. I love to hear music. I love to read. I do a lot of solitary things because I'm an introvert, but I'm a very happy introvert. And by hearing other people's stories like yours, which is so, so powerful, by speaking with my guests each Friday on my podcast, people that honestly I would never meet. I live in a small village in southwest Louisiana. I'm 10 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. We eat a ton of shrimp. We eat more shrimp than we eat chicken. It's a good life. It could be much worse if I allowed it. I'm not going to allow it. I walk around going, you know what? Life is good. Yeah, I just, you know, had a little bit of a mini fit. That was 10 minutes ago. I'm fine.
Yeah.
When you're talking with people and you realize that they may be living in a really rotten reality, like they're almost in a loop, what can you share with them to say, hey, you're in a loop. Knock it off, you know, pay attention to something different. I'm sure you've got some great advice. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I you know, it's funny. I used to have great advice for stuff like that because, you know, I've actually written a couple of books around the topic of leadership development, which at the end of the day is self-development. And so I have some textbook viewpoints on that. But I think the one thing that I default to nowadays in my life is just empathy. Just show empathy to people like that who are going through those loops. And somehow your empathy is going to be more powerful than any advice you could give them because you're not really living that reality yourself. And the textbook advice that people give sometimes is not as powerful as, you know what, I hear you, I see you, and I understand you. And that's all I'm here to tell you is that I get it. I'm here to understand. You know, it's funny. I was watching a movie. I was watching a movie where someone was saying that that there's an Aborigine phrase for "I love you," which is it goes like this. Australian Aborigine. It goes, "I see you," okay? "I see you," or "I sing you," something like that. And because I can sing you and I can see you, that means I love you, you know? And I think that's all we need to do is share empathy. In fact, in the Igbo language, my language back from West Africa, there is no word for love. You can't say that to someone, "I love you." There's no way to do that. But what you can say is what they do say is, "Aharam ginanya." And for anyone who's of Igbo descent, who is listening to this, they know exactly what I mean. Aharam ginanya means I see you in my eyes. That means I love you. All right? If I can see you, that means I love you. So it's very similar to the Aborigine way of saying I sing you or I see you. So for me, if someone's going through these loops, they're having a bad day, they're having a bad decade, I'll just say, "Hey, I hear you. I see you. And now what can we do to make a change," right? So that you don't perceive your world this way. Yeah.
And it's not only that. A lot of times the most empathetic we need to be is with ourselves. Look, I don't know about you, but I have often said that if any person, male or female, spoke to me in a way that I speak to my own self, I'd knock them in the head.
Yeah.
But we do. We have a tendency to be really vicious to ourselves and about ourselves. And I think being empathetic about our own selves, you know, stop and think. I mean, I'll get a little cranky. I'll be working on a website, and all of a sudden, none of my technology is working. It's just not working. And I'll start to have a little meltdown. And I immediately, once I catch on that I'm cursing at myself or saying bad words or calling myself an idiot, which, you know, we all do, I will immediately get up, walk out, leave my computer monitor open, leave my notepad, I just leave, and I walk off, and I start asking myself, okay, what you're telling yourself, is this true? Is this really true? What can you do about it? Can you take a break? Do you need to drink water? Do you need to take a walk with the dog? Do something different. And then once you start going, okay, Denise, you've got this. You're feeling better. You're not nearly as stupid as you thought you were 10 minutes ago. Things get better.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a little note on my wall that I've left there now for the longest time that says, "The enemy within." The enemy within is my own mind, my own negative thoughts, and my own fears. So I always want to remind myself that I am the enemy because I'm the one who's telling myself these bad stories and these fearful, negative non-truths. So I agree with you 100%.
It can be very difficult if you don't keep an eye on what you're telling yourself, because so often what we're telling ourselves is just garbage. It's plain old-fashioned garbage, but we keep believing it. we keep playing in it, and it's a mess, and it's time to, you know, pay attention to what other people are saying and doing, and paying attention to how you are responding and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it just, it makes a lot of difference if you're kinder to yourself. Listen, this has been a fascinating story, and I'm so glad that you shared so much of this. So let's go on, and honestly, we may have to do a second show because we've got so much still to go on. But let's talk about your podcast, because, I mean, one of the mm-hmm. things that I love to do is podcasts. You know, I've been doing this for 10 years, and yeah, I mm-hmm. probably will do it until the day that I wake up and go, I'm 100 years old. I think I'll go to sleep now. But who knows? But let's talk about how you started that. And I also want to talk about the chapters in your book, because you talk about the importance of story, psychology, and relationships. And I think that you do the same thing with your podcast. So do you mind kind mm-hmm. of taking off and sharing how you got started with the book, or the podcast, or however you want to make this happen?
Yeah, no, I've written 5 books now, and the first book was a novel, but everything else has been nonfiction. And what I've tried to do with every book is, you know, reflect on a real problem that I've experienced, do the research on that problem, find a set of solutions, put things together, and then share and teach. And this book was exactly that same formula. And the problem I experienced in this book, what I'm referring to is called Big Ticket Clients. Okay, Big Ticket Clients. You can't catch a whale with a worm. I'll explain the title in a minute. But the problem I experienced before I wrote this book was a problem that I think most, if not all, coaches and consultants go through in today's internet online technology. And that is, when we first decide that we're going to start looking for customers online, so versus going to the business networking meetings or, you know, the referral things and one-on-one and all that, when we decide we're going to start marketing online, the first thing we learn, the first set of teachers we get, are these people that a lot of us like to call gurus, okay? They're sort of influencers, they're famous, and they're all telling us that we should be doing mass marketing. You know, send out a bunch of emails, blast out on Facebook, advertise everywhere, okay? And after we learn all the technologies and the culture and the system of that kind of sales and marketing, and after we find out that it may or may not work for us, when we're trying to go after bigger ticket clients, that's when everything breaks down and we're like, oh my gosh, I can't keep sending this spammy stuff every day on LinkedIn. I can't keep advertising to people I don't know. I don't have the money for it. I can't sustain this approach. And then we find ourselves stuck because we want big ticket clients who pay you more, who receive more value from you, but the methods that we first learned do not work for getting big ticket clients to sign up with us. You know, I have a mentor, his name is Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, and he wrote a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And Dr. Goldsmith he's huge. He's like international biggest coach on the planet, maybe. But he was kind enough to read my book and review it and gave me amazing quotes that I have on my website right now. But that philosophy that what got you here won't get you there is exactly the point I'm making in my book. Dr. Goldsmith's point is that if you're a great technician or individual contributor at work, once you become a leader and a manager, what got you to be great one-on-one on your own will not help you when it's time to lead other people. That was his point. What I discovered is that if you first start marketing online, all the spammy emails, all the, you know, sort of a quick attention getters, multiple videos that people launch driving in their Bentleys, all the things, the little tricks that people use, they do not work once you scale up and want to start acquiring bigger companies, bigger ticket clients. So you've got to learn new things. So that's how I've got to write a book that teaches people how to market to bigger clients, how to be value-based, relationship-based, and how not to be spammy like all these small ticket marketing strategies that are out there. So that's what got me to write the book. The podcast was really just a natural offshoot of the book. In fact, in my book, I spend 10 of the 12 chapters talking about the need for storytelling, the need for the intentional use of psychology triggers, and the focus on relationship building. So that's story, psychology, and relationships. I spend 10 chapters teaching how those three things are the most important things you can do if you want big ticket clients. However, by chapter 11, I focus on the one mechanism that I have found to be the most powerful way to connect with big ticket clients in today's market, and that is podcasting. You know, Denise, you mentioned earlier that, you know, one of the things you love about podcasting is that you get to talk for an hour or more with people that you may have never been able to meet in any other circumstance because of the format and magic of podcasting. People want to come on your podcast because they want to expose their story to the world. So you're going to get an incentive for people to join right there. And then you can build a relationship right there on that 30 or 1 hour conversation that could turn into a lifelong friendship or business relationship going forward. So I have found podcasting to be the honest, truthful way to build a relationship with people you don't know online without having to send all these spammy emails and act like you're a big guru and all those other little tricks that people play. So that's kind of how I got into podcasting. So the title of my book and my podcast is Big Ticket Clients. That's, you know, how to get big ticket clients. And then I make the little point, you can't catch a whale with a worm. So if you remember my analogy here of what got you there won't get you there. What got you here, rather, won't get you there. It's the same kind of thing. You can't use worms to catch whales because whales, big ticket clients, they don't eat worms. They eat tons and tons and tons of plankton. So if you imagine, you know, a fisherman who goes out to sea trying to catch a whale with one single worm, he's going to fail. And that's how I failed trying to get big ticket clients using all these emails and LinkedIn connections and all the things that people do for small ticket clients.
You're absolutely speaking my language. I am a marketing expert. I do a lot of marketing for my clients. And I'm very careful about how we position them because if they come to me and say, okay, you know, we want to do this, you know, the gurus, like you mentioned, you know, I've got to have Instagram stories and I've got to have this and I've got to have that. Okay, but what are you actually telling people? How are you actually communicating with them? How are you actually, you know, making sure that they get that you care about them? And they're like, all I know is I just need to do this stuff. No, you really don't. So that's a whole another talk that we'll probably have. But listen, you're right about podcasting. I started podcasting, 2001 maybe? No, 2010, I'm sorry. Probably 2009 I got serious about, hang on. My voice just went south. I got serious around 2010. And do you know who Larry Winget is?
I do not.
Okay, Larry Winget has written six. You'll love him. He's written six New York Times bestsellers. He's often on Fox, CNN. I mean, he's all over the place. I like to identify him as, you know, Larry Winget. He'll tell you how the corn grows. He's not going to play with you. He's going to tell you exactly what it is that he has to say, and if you don't like it, oh well, but he's never going to be rude or nasty, but he's very, very smart. He's just a really great guy. And I was stumped on my, you know, how do I get podcast clients? How do I even want to keep doing this? I mean, it's a lot of work to do a podcast, as you know, and then you really want to have terrific guests. You don't want to just have somebody that talks and you say, okay, thank you, bye. I mean, you want to make sure that your audience gets the best part of your guest, right? So Larry Winget, I had interviewed a couple of other authors, and I think this is about where I figured out that interviewing authors and business owners was really my sweet spot because I love authors. Look, I will read 5 to 10 books a week. I kid you not. So authors, my sweet spot. So all of a sudden I went, you know, I have been a fan of his work. I've got several of his books. I sent him a note on Facebook, introduced who I was, you know, told him that I had, you know, interviewed a couple of his very well-known speakers. You know, Larry is a huge keynote speaker. And, you know, I sent him a note, told him, I mean, it was very clear what it was, who I was, what I was asking for. And I thought, okay, that's the end of that. I'm probably going to just give this up. 10 minutes later, he said, I'd love to. I went, oh, you're kidding me. Larry Winget saved my podcast. I kid you not. And he's a terrific guy. I mean, he's seriously one of my favorite people. And from there, I just got very, very busy every Friday, unless something happens like it did last week. Every Friday, I'm showing up, and I love Fridays. I kid you not. I love Fridays. I get to talk with people like you. Then, you know, and you mentioned it earlier, you know, you create these relationships. You know, you refer each other. Who knows what's going to happen? Some of my favorite cards come from my podcast clients and, you know, visitors. Yes. So you just never know. I mean, I think it's a terrific way to really get your voice heard. And that's one of the terms that I use, get your voice heard with podcasting. Yep. I agree with you.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk a bit. You said something that really kind of struck me. You're talking about the story, the psychology and relationships. You said psychology triggers. Can you share a bit about those? You know, what are you telling people that they need to really make sure that we're sharing as a host? What are the psychology triggers that you recommend?
Okay. So just to give people some context, you know, regarding what I mean by psychology triggers, you know, the internet and the marketing world on the internet has really grown up to adopt a set of psychology triggers that were all defined by a gentleman named Robert Cialdini, or Cialdini, I should say. I apologize for that. Robert Cialdini. And then now that's a guy I would love to get on my podcast, by the way, talking about great podcast guests. He's incredible. But Robert Cialdini wrote this book called Persuasion, a book before that called Influence. And both of these books talk about seven psychology triggers. So things like social proof, things like scarcity, you know, unity. He has defined, put words to behaviors that people demonstrate online that many of us are quite used to. So, for example, what do I mean by social proof? Just a moment.
Sorry, say it again.
I'm sorry. Did you hear what I said?
No, I lost you.
I think
you.
I may have cut out. Oh, no,
okay.
Not a problem. I'm back. So scarcity, for example, it's a psychology that says, you know, if I tell you that you have only 2 days, you know, and that's the only time you have before you can get this offer, and after that, the offer is gone. A lot of people, the way they'll behave, especially online, is they will rush to go get that offer. And so a lot of people have read Cialdini's book. A lot of people know these things intuitively, and they use them all the time. Now, I think they abuse them a lot of the time because, you know, you get people offering things like, hey, I have a sale right now, and if you click right now, you'll get it. But if you don't click in an hour, you won't get it, blah, blah, blah. And then 2 hours later, you'll click and it's still there. Now the excuse is, oh, we decided to change the rule. We're going to give you one more hour.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big game, you know.
More and more of us are aware of that. And now the thing is,
exactly. They'll
say, okay, you know, we've got 24 hours. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And then all of a sudden, and I saw this with a very well-known marketer that I'm a little ticked about, and I'm not going to say who it was, but I really thought they would have known better. It's two big name marketers who really should have known better. It's not good. But what happened was, you know, you buy this thing with all the bonuses and all this and that. And listen, I did buy it, and it is a terrific course. I'm not kidding you. It's one of the best I have ever seen. I went ahead and invested. And one of my business partner, I kept texting her, don't let me do this. What the heck? You let me do this. So we did.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's a terrific course. But the problem is that all of a sudden, within about 72 hours, they started letting another wave in. You know, they were taking down some of the bonuses, but it was pretty shitty. Excuse my language.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only thing I can come up with. And I'm not happy about it. So
everybody, sorry about the language,
but it was wrong.
Yeah, and what they were doing was they were intentionally using the psychology trigger called scarcity, which is people want what they can't have. People want what they can't have. So I find that these are very manipulative. I find that, you know, I mean, and there are several. In fact, I've just pulled up a list of them here. The ones that Cialdini came up with are liking, which is people work with people they like. Another one is authority. People defer to experts. Another is reciprocity. People will repay in kind to whatever you do to them. If you give them something, they'll want to give you something. Another is unity. So if you have a shared identity with people, like family or maybe whatever club that you create that makes everybody feel similar. And then we just talked about scarcity and then social proof. Those are the main ones, the main seven that he came up with. And people have just abuse them, and they use them all the time. And it keeps working because these psychology triggers, if you will, get at the core of human nature. So what I did was I wrote in my book that you do need to respect the fact that these work, and you have to intentionally use them. So if you're going to write an email that says, okay, in this email, I'm going to touch on at least one or two or three psychology triggers. And that becomes your outline. That becomes your template for writing that email. Number one, I'm going to touch on authority. I'm going to make people know that I'm an authority. So that's going to be one of my outline points because I know people defer to experts. Another is I'm going to try to do something that gives value. So I'm going to use the psychology of reciprocity. Giving value means I'm not just going to write you an email that tells you how great I am. I'm going to teach you something or give you a free something or whatever. So my focus is on intentionally using psychology, but not abusing it. So what I did in my book is that I came up with 10 more psychology triggers because, you know, Cialdini came up with 7, but that doesn't mean that, you know, those are the only ones that work. And I'll give you some examples of mine. Proximity. The psychology of proximity says that the sales likelihood is highest in proximity to the sales event. So don't let someone, after you've told someone your offer is going to be $1,000, don't let them go away for two months waiting for a decision, because you're not going to hear back from them if price is an issue. Get that decision within that time period or a day or something from that time period. Proximity, it works all the time. The same person you get a decision from now will probably not want to go give you that deal 2 weeks from now just because of proximity. Then there are things like friction. People want things to be done easy. There's the psychology of fame and celebrity. We all know that one. There's the psychology of certainty. If you're someone who speaks in a language that makes people feel confident about what you do and what you offer, they'll defer to you. But if you don't have certainty, and it carries through your voice, your emails, everything you do, you know, all of that. The psychology of pain, which is people move away from pain and toward pleasure. I mean, Tony Robbins wrote tons of books on that one. The psychology of authenticity. People are disarmed by authenticity. Authenticity truly sells. So back to your original question, which is which of these psychology tools, if you will, or triggers, should people make sure they use? I would say, first of all, get to know all of them. Because if you know all of them and they are in your toolkit, then when one thing isn't working in your marketing, you can always fix it. The problem most of us have is what I call copycat marketing. We take what someone else has done out there. We don't understand the psychology triggers behind it. We don't know why it works. And then we implement it in our own area and find out that maybe the variables in our world are different from the variables in that person's world, and it fails. And then we can't fix it. So I would recommend learning all of these and then picking and choosing and intentionally using one psychology trigger or the other. Some of my favorites are, I call this the psychology of empathy. You know, showing that you really care about people is one fantastic way of getting them to turn around and care about you. And you've already mentioned that, you know, earlier on. So there's a lot to learn, but it's really valuable learning because you'll now have a new language, a language of influence that allows you to help people break through the noise and listen to you and your offer.
Exactly. Listen, I have said for many, many years that we are in a know, like, and trust economy. And if you have proven one way or another, like, you know, this group of people just did with me, and I can't even begin to tell you how disappointed I am, that I can't really trust them anymore. It's heartbreaking. But guess what? Chances are they're not going to get any more of my money. And they really they did something that they shouldn't have done. And I'm not the only one going, what the heck? It was just a bad move. If you say it's not going to be available for another 6 months, don't slap it up in a different form 72 hours from now just because you can. I mean, just don't do it.
Yeah. Yep.
So you have to be able, people have to trust you, and they have to trust you kind of forever and ever, amen, don't they? And I think that's where marketing really fails.
Yeah, and that's why I focus on the third sort of thing about this three-legged stool is relationships. So we've talked a lot about story and storytelling and story listening. We've talked about psychology now. But the third and probably the most important key is relationships, because it's relationship 101 to do what you say you're going to do, which is the problem that you experience, right? Just be honest. I mean, if you ask someone to go on a date, how about showing up for that date? Don't stand them up, because if you stand them up, you're going to lose the know, like, and trust equation that you just mentioned. So relationship building is the focus. But if you look at what I call small ticket marketing strategies, relationships are not the focus, right? If you look at these folks who are advertising on Facebook and different places, they're not trying to build a relationship with you. They want you to click a button, go to a landing page, put in your email address, watch the video, get on a one-hour call so they can sell you on all of your problems and the solution that they have to all of your problems. That's not building a relationship, okay? It's a funnel, yeah. It works for a lot of people, but the kind of people that I serve and that, you know, I call them big-ticket clients, you know, not big companies, but they're usually small to medium-sized companies. But the point is, they're making real change and impact in their businesses and people's lives, and they're happy to pay a little bit more for someone who build a relationship with them. So that's the distinction, really. It's shifting from transactional marketing to relationship-based marketing.
And honestly, I can hear some of the audience going, but I need those transactions. That's how I pay my mortgage. We all need those transactions. But I think what you're saying and what I'm hearing anyway is that, yes, you need to have those transactions, but you need to follow through and make sure that they are always in your line of sight. You know, don't just sell them once. Just say, hey, great, thank you, see ya. And that happens often than anything.
Yeah, it's really a transition that people have to make. In fact, in chapter one of my book, I say, we're not going to talk about anything except a decision that you have to make right now. You know, it's called a robust decision, by the way, in the book, and I explain that. But the point is, you've got to make that decision that says, I will henceforth give the time to build relationships. I will henceforth focus on big ticket clients and stop using these smaller ticket spammy strategies. You know, if you don't make that decision, you'll always be stuck in the loop of feeling confused about what you're doing, the strategies you're using. I had a heartbreaking meeting once, heartbreaking to me. At the end of the meeting, at the prospect I was talking to, after spending almost 2 hours talking to this person, she told me, you know, I really love everything you're saying. Your stuff is just, light years ahead of anything I've ever seen. But you know what? I want to make money this month. I want to earn my clients right now. I can't wait for, you know, the long-term thing you're talking about. And it was heartbreaking to me because I just know that if she would have made the decision to say, you know what, I'm going to stop going after this certain client base that, number one, doesn't have any money to pay me, okay, and is all about transactions, and I'm going to start focusing on longer-term, real value-based relationships and clients, that I just know she would be more successful. If you go after people paying you $10, you need 1,000 of those $10 to make $10,000. But if you go after people paying you $1,000, you need only 10 of them. You know, so it's just a decision that we all have to make. Do we want to go after big ticket clients, or do we want to stay small? That's it. That's the decision. So
exactly.
I think the decision is number one.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I've seen this time and time again. Listen, most of my clients have been with me for 10 years or better. Most of them. I only lost 2 clients. I'm a web developer. I'm an online business manager. I'm a techie person. I'm known as a nerd in stilettos. Mm-hmm. I kid you not. But the thing is, I have kept my clients all of these years because they are always in my line of sight. I'm always finding something new or better or making a suggestion. We're rebuilding their websites. I have one client, I just rebuilt his website for the 4th time. Yeah, I mean, it just gets better and more gorgeous each time. But I made the decision very early on that my clients would be my clients. It's not a money transaction. It's not me going, here you go, you know, here's your thank you for the payment, good luck and God bless. I just don't operate that way. And it has served me very, very well over time. And honestly, I don't advertise. I haven't advertised. All of my work is done by relationships, by referrals. It's always been that way. And I wish more people would say, you know, I'm going to do the absolute best I can do with each one of my clients, gain more clients. You just do whatever it is that I have to do, but they're going to be large transactions and they're going to be happy transactions. Instead of, you know, buying that $10 widget and selling the heck out of it. It depends on what you want. But, you know, if you really want to grow, you need to become basically a relationship expert with your clients. There's no question about it.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, we are speaking each other's language. This is fun. Okay, listen, we've only got about 2.5 minutes. I told you this was the quickest 60 minutes on the internet. Let's talk about your music very quickly. Why has it been such a powerful voice for you? I mean, is there anything that you would do different right now?
No, I'm very happy with where music has arrived in my life because I started out kind of with a wrong view of music in the 90s. So I told you that when I was, you know, when I first got introduced to music, it was as a tool for healing and a tool for sort of reflection and truth. But in the 90s, I got into the world of trying to make money from my music. And I discovered painfully that's kind of a lottery out there. It's not going to happen for everyone. Now, I would put my music against anybody's in terms of quality, production, anything. But I've since learned that music has to go back to being a tool for healing and support and motivation and inspiration and so on. So in my book, the last chapter, chapter 12, I give the gift of music. I have 10 songs that speak to the motivation we all need to implement these changes in our marketing and in our lives. If we're going to be successful, we're going to have to make changes. And sometimes the best way to weather storms is by listening to music and really internalizing positive messages that get us going. So that's what I've done with music, and I'm happy that music is part of my book and part of my life, and I still go out to bars and play music. But I've accepted the fact that I'm not going to be Michael Jackson. Okay, that's not going to happen, and I'm okay with that. So that's my current relationship with music.
I love that. Okay, you also use the gift of music. So where can people, is there somewhere online that they can find your music? Mm-hmm. I think there's a meditation tool that you mentioned.
Yes, Music for Meditation and Motivation is part of my current book. So if you go to Amazon and you buy the book for you know, the Big Ticket Clients book. I have an audio book version you can listen to, but then I also have links to the music in chapter 12. So you can actually go to iTunes, you can get it on Spotify, you can get it anywhere. So the best case scenario is just go to my book, buy the book, and you'll get access to the music as well. And then you can also do all of that from my website, which is drpele.com, drpele.com.
Got it. Dr. Pele, thank you so much for being here. It has been an enormous pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and advice that you've shared with our audience. And by the way, if you're looking for podcast guests, I've got a ton of them I would love to share with you.
While we were talking, I was thinking,
I need to introduce him to, I was writing names down.
Yeah.
Let's talk.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Before we say goodbye, I would love to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcast. Just look for your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your journey.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.